This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 16th of June, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. First up, we find out about the playful side of brutalist architecture in a new exhibition that recreates some of the 1960s most experimental and intriguing concrete structures.
They built these bizarre structures, these playgrounds, which have been completely sort of overlooked in the mainstream narrative about brutalism.
Then we down our gaze to discuss the delights and downfalls of fashion's most grounded garment, the shoe.
The Cinderella story is found in many cultures, but it always features a shoe. It's something that really struck as a very important feature of the power of transformation in shoes.
All that to come and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up, we turn our attention to Britain's long unloved concrete behemoths of brutalist architecture. Although many of these buildings from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s are now being re-evaluated and appreciated for their experimental and sculptural qualities, brutalist buildings are often seen as harsh and uninviting edifices. It's a little-known fact, however, that play areas were built into many of London's post-war housing estates. These extraordinary areas were designed to offer free rein to the imagination and a safe haven for children to play in. But in the 1970s, these designs fell out of favour. Health and safety concerns were voiced, and many were deemed inappropriate and even dangerous. Using archives, photos and plans, artist Simon Terrell and Turner Prize-nominated architectural collective Assemble have recreated some of those brutalist play spaces at the Royal Institute of British Architects' new gallery space in London. Monocle's playful producer David Pleasant met Simon Terrell to give the playground a go for himself.
We're sitting in an installation at the RABA called the Brutalist Playground. And we're actually sitting on these hexagonal shapes that are a direct one-to-one scale of some original concrete playground shapes, but they're made in foam.
As you've described, and behind us there's this disc, it's quite hard to describe, with a railing around it. That, again, mimicking a design. Perhaps tell us what that design was, where it was, who designed it, and so on.
The design is, it's called the Flying Saucer, and it was originally in Churchill Gardens in Pimlico. The image of this was the first thing that inspired us. We had this title, the Brutalist Playground, when we first undertook the collaboration. I asked Assemble if they'd like to work with me on this, and all we had was the title. But then we found an image of what the structure that we're sitting on now, and it's this remarkable concrete flying saucer that is, it's kind of ambiguous whether it's taking off or it's crashed into the ground, but it's a sort of giant concrete structure, and it's so kind of odd that it immediately captured our interest.
And odd also in that it's meant to be an area or a thing to play with or on, and that sort of leads me to my next question. Remarkably, a lot of the architects of the era, we're talking about the, say, the 50s, 60s, in considered areas of play in the designs of the housing, but that kind of fell out of favour. Maybe tell us why. Is there a sort of health and safety issue? Were people's views on playing and so on, did they change? I mean, maybe tell us a bit about the course of what happened and maybe what you're trying to do in revitalising that.
They've changed remarkably, actually, over this period of time. Many of these architects at the time who were building these brutalist structures were very, you know, they're very socially minded and very socially orientated people. Erno Goldfinger, for example, was really concerned. His whole reason for building high-rises was to open up space below for things like play, public space, leisure space, and also greenery. And he wanted to surround the whole of Hampstead Heath with tower blocks and connect that park down to central London, for example. But in doing that as well, they built these bizarre structures of these playgrounds, which have been completely sort of overlooked in the mainstream kind of narrative about the brutalism.
Do any of them survive now? I mean, could you or I go and see them in situ, or are they kind of long gone? Is it just these wonderful archive photos that are from the ROBA archives? Is that all that remains?
Almost. There's one playground left in London, and it's at the foot of the Balfron Tower. It's fenced off now. It was decommissioned, actually, a long time ago. It originally had a metal slide, a little paddling pool, and a sand pit, but that went in the 70s. And all of the rest, they only exist in the archive now. So it was quite an undertaking for us to, with the ROBA, to trawl the archive and find what we could. And there is not a whole lot, really, but it was just a couple of key images, and luckily two of the original drawings that enabled Jane and Joe from Assemble to extrapolate from those drawings these one-to-one scale structures. And they've just been kind of squashed into this gallery space as a kind of quite a tight fit, really.
In quite a remarkable way. Maybe we can also talk about what's being projected behind us, which are some of those images. Maybe talk us through a few examples. You know, what are we looking at?
What we've got now is the original architect's drawing of the flying saucer. And so that's all that exists. And here, the next image coming up is the first image that inspired us, which is truly quite an oddity. Of it's an ambiguous structure. It's made out of bush hammered concrete, so it's rough. You know, you lose the skin of your elbows in no time at all if you're not careful on something like that.
There's some friends here enjoying it behind us. Luckily, they're in no danger of scraping their skin because it's pretty soft foam that's recreated here.
Well, the great thing about this foam discovery that Assemble made was that it looks like bush hammered concrete, but it's soft. And in a way, the logic of this installation, much of the brutalism, you know, was concerned with truth to materials, truth to concrete. And so this installation, in a way, is like truth to foam. It has been constructed, and it's the cheapest, lowest grade foam that you find inside furniture.
And it's really rather a beautiful pattern, this sort of aggregate. It looks like marble. There's something rather Italianate about it in the colours, the pastel colours that have been chosen. Are you kind of surprised in how it's all come together? You know, what are your impressions as someone so, you know, pivotal to this project?
Kind of astonished that we got away with it and it works. The first moment happened 2 days ago when some kids came in and we were quite anxious. I mean, maybe they would just hate it and leave. But he actually went wild in here and stayed for quite some time. So it wasn't until that moment, after, you know, more than 6 months of working on this, that we knew, yes, it does seem to work after all. But the colour of this foam actually is an important point as well, because the colour corresponds with its density. So we've got a green base in the foam, a pink base and a blue base, and each of those has a different density, and so they're used in different ways. The blue on the floor and the pink on the Balfron structure and the green on the flying saucer. And with this slight different density and thickness, it was kind of like the colour choices were already made just by the materiality itself.
And now it's such a soft approach. And maybe my last question is, do you see, and I know your own work and concern has been with brutalism and some of the architectural exponents of that, do you see your mission really to sort of soften the image of brutalism? I think maybe we've reached the point where enough people appreciate the importance of it. Do you think this show is just further sort of evidence or form of kind of archaeology in terms of telling people what brutalism was about?
I'd hope that something about moving beyond the cliche of brutalism, beyond the, you know, the horror movie set that it traditionally was. The Balfron Tower has always, you know, been that way. But of course, then there's the whole lived experience of it. And the photograph I made there with the original residents there, who, you know, social housing tenants who'd lived there many for their entire lives,
who have now gone.
Well, that's the awful part of this story. When I made that photograph, it had just been announced that they were to leave and they would not be able to return. And so it was an incredibly emotional time, as you can imagine. It was an awful time. And I'd just got there. I'd just moved from Australia. So I was a complete outsider, and I found myself sort of thrust into this world that I really didn't know much of anything about. And to be in a tower block, sort of in a way packed with this kind of level of emotion, was a remarkable experience. And it was certainly nothing to do with those cliches of brutalism. People who lived there loved the place, and they were devastated to have to leave.
And you can tell if places like this, anything like this kind of existed once in such places, you can perhaps understand why more people than one might imagine actually did love those places. And maybe there's some sort of lessons, design, architectural or otherwise, that we can now apply to our buildings now?
Well, I mean, with this show, we're not trying to make any claims or statements like that. But I think in general, that question, there was something wonderful about the high-minded ideals of the time. And, you know, this was ambitious thinking that went into these housing projects. And, I mean, you know, it's a complicated story. But much of that story seems to be a failure of management, not architecture.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant speaking to artist Simon Terrell at the Brutalist Playground installation at the Royal Institute of British Architects in London. Next up, we step into the world of shoe design. A good pair of shoes can provide pleasure, anticipation, and excitement. But ill-fitting and badly designed ones can create exactly the opposite effect. And so the Victoria and Albert Museum in London is hosting an exhibition dedicated to balmy boots, ludicrous loafers and haute high heels. From the 13th of June, the exhibition Shoes, Pleasure and Pain runs through over 250 pairs that range from fanciful modern slip-ons to a version of Cinderella's famous crystal slipper. Monocle's sure-footed reporter Fernando Augusto Pacheco stepped in to find out more from the co-curator of the exhibition, Lucia Savi.
What's that sound? I like that sound. I love that sound.
It's the sound of my shoes.
Shoes, Pleasure and Pain, yes, such an evocative title. Of course, shoes are very important of the way we walk, the way we appear, and the way we define ourselves. And this has been very important through different culture, and we're showing it through the exhibition with a thematic approach to the whole display. And the pleasure of wearing beautiful crafted shoes, the pleasure of owning such three-dimensional, almost like works of art. And of course, if you look through the cases of the exhibition, you'll see that throughout history, human beings have wanted to encrust their feet in shoes that are not much related to the shape of the human feet. So even the golden sandal from ancient Egypt that dated 30 BC is kind of geometrical shaped. So there is not much relationship with the natural foot. So the pain of having to wear such an abstract sometimes footwear. And this is something that you'll see throughout history. And I think it's closely related to the fact that shoes have a transformative nature in them.
It's interesting because the pieces are very international. They come from different regions, you know, China, India, France. But in a way, it's not that they're similar, you know, the way they look, but it's all about the same message in a way, don't you think?
That was the aim. The aim of the exhibition is to show there are certain way of behavior and certain aspirational factors that repeating themselves in different cultures. So for instance, one of the cases you'll see how platform can be used from ancient Greece. We have a little statue of the goddess Aphrodite wearing very high platform heels. And then you find them again in Renaissance Italy, in Venice, and then again in China. And nowadays with very high money platform heels. So that was the idea, is to show that nothing is new and there are some recurring themes throughout history. And actually we have a lot to learn from history, of course.
Before we talk about some of the iconic female shoes that I want to discuss, I just want to mention there's also for men as well. So will men have the same thing as women, you know, when you talk about shoes, or how's the difference?
I think men and women have a very similar attitude to shoes, even though women have always been associated with shoes, but actually men, and you'll see it again through history, have a very close relationship with their shoes. Maybe you might want to find out that actually heels were first invented for men for horse riding, and Louis XIV was actually the one that introduced the red sole and the red heel for his court, so not La Boutin for women. So it's actually quite interesting to see that men, as much as women, have been quite attentive to the way they walk and the way they project themselves through their shoes.
And also, it's interesting, you also mentioned, of course, some fiction and characters. We're here on the second floor. There's a beautiful quote by Cinderella: "A shoe can change a life." That's quite an interesting one as well.
Yeah, Cinderella actually plays an important role in this exhibition. The first case, the first section of the exhibition is called Transformation. And we look at Cinderella throughout cultures, because Cinderella is not only the one we know through Disney and through the Western version with the glass slipper, but actually the Cinderella story is found in many cultures, in ancient Egypt, in China, in Native America, and actually its Cinderella story has different features, quite similar. It's about the girl that needs to find her place in society, but it always features a shoe. So it's something that really struck as a very important feature of the power of transformation in shoes. And you'll see that how it's been used as well in modern mythology with films and advertisements. So it's actually very important that Cinderella is up here as well.
And talking about, you know, film and everything, it's so interesting, how does it affect, for example, the Manolo Blahniks? I mean, of course, people knew about them, but after Sex and the City, they certainly exploded, no? And it's interesting you included that as well in the show.
Yes, because Sex and the City has played an important role, especially for the everyday woman that maybe, you know, people in the know, as you said, they knew about Manolo Blahnik, but actually through the TV series and through the fictional character of Carrie Bradshaw, everybody, even men, are now aware who Manolo Blahnik is and what he represents and what his shoes are representing, actually. And so, yes, it's important as well, because, of course, shoes become aspirational through certain individuals. In the past, maybe it was the royalties. So we have shoes from Queen Victoria, the Queen Mother, as well as the ruling class in different culture. And nowadays, maybe it's about through the fairy tale shoe designer. And this is had to be addressed here.
And finally, we're here on the second floor of the exhibition. One very interesting part is about how to create one of those shoes as well. So it's not only about the piece, but you kind of explain how the whole process behind.
Yes, actually, it's one of the favorite parts of the exhibition for me. It's a very large case where we kind of exploded a shoe, and we look at the various stages that you need in order to create a final shoe. And what I found it very interesting is, like, when you have bespoke shoes, you need to take, first of all, the shape of a fit. So we have a book where the shape of various people's feet have recorded with their bunions and with their older personal note. And that's how you start with the measurements, and then from there you create the last, which records your characteristic, the type of shoes you want, so the height of the heel, the kind of shape of the bump, and then from there the various bits and pieces, prototype, pieces of leather, pieces of fabric, the different type of heels. So I think it's very important to show people the crafts that is involved in how to make shoes.
Just take off your shoes.
The shoes stay on my feet. The shoes stay on my feet. The shoes stay on my feet. The shoes stay on my feet.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Lucia Salvi, co-curator of Shoes, Pleasure and Pain, which is now on at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. From the beginning of the 20th century, hundreds of thousands of people have fled communist regimes from the Soviet Union to North Korea and found refuge in Canada. It's something the Canadian government wants to commemorate with a new memorial to the victims of communism, located in Ottawa. The modernist design is composed of a series of grey concrete slabs etched with images depicting starvation and massacre. But it's where the new memorial will be placed that is causing outcry. Some say the plot of land between the Supreme Court of Canada and National Library is a poor choice. So Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis spoke to architect Robert Alsop to find out more about the controversy.
The original location for the capital was decided by Queen Victoria back in the middle of the 19th century. There was an architectural competition held. A brilliant solution, the Victorian Gothic Revival buildings were selected, which exactly, we think, matched the wild landscape on which they were situated, sitting on a very high piece of the ground. Not long after that, all the plans then, following legislation, the establishment of the Supreme Court of Canada. For quite a long time, the Supreme Court of Canada did not have a home. And it wasn't until the 1940s that the Supreme Court of Canada established a position. But the plans, starting from roughly the beginning of the 20th century, all had the Supreme Court on a promontory that was somewhat smaller but similar to the promontory of the Parliament Hill. And all the plans had that position for the Supreme Court, and all of the plans had a square or lawn forecourt to that building. So the plans that have been prepared for government for Parliament and for the expansion of the federal courts, which is structured under the Supreme Court system.
When you look at, say, the controversy surrounding the proposed monument to the victims of communism, for example, from your vantage point, what do you make of that reaction and that controversy?
Well, it comes from various places, but I think the main concern is it's the wrong site. That this site has been earmarked for the federal courts for a very long time. And it's part of an urban design idea about giving shape to the square in front of the Supreme Court. So on one side of that square is already built what is referred to as the Justice Building. That's the name of that building. And on the other side of the square, there's a vacant site. It's a lawn right now. And that's the site that's been selected for the federal court building.
When you look at an area at the heart of the capital city of Canada with all its history and all its symbolism and all its significance, as you've outlined already, what do you think that this site and the idea of sort of monuments and memorials and state buildings, I guess, in Ottawa should or could say about Canada as a nation today?
Well, I think one needs to think about the commemorations of various kinds in a sort of hierarchy. The most significant ones, and the most significant one that we have, is the National War Museum at the head of Elgin Street within Confederation Square, which is, of course, connected to Parliament Hill, and it interconnects with Wellington Street. Similar kinds of intersections, main intersections within what it's now been called Confederation Boulevard, which is a ring that surrounds the main landscape and extends across to the city of Gatineau to make a national capital of two cities. Where the main intersections are, there you would expect to see not the equivalent, things in that higher order of commemoration, the things that are fundamental to Canadian history and life and memory. So obviously the War Memorial is a really key one in that regard. The other one, I think, of similar kind is the Peacekeeping Monument, which is close to the National Gallery, the Art Gallery. It intersects, again, a major intersection at the entrance to the main central part of Ottawa. Then I think there's a second level, and there is a policy that's been developed by the National Capital Commission, a newly formed group, which is referred to as the Canadian Heritage. It's a department of government. They have policies about how to cite things, what kind of level of commemoration they appear to be, and what the suitable sites might be. So they really have three levels. The first I've referred to, the ones that are of immense significance to the country as a whole, and the second tier, of course, being less broadly based, I guess that is the terminology, and the third level. So when you look at what commemorations there are in the city, which we have done over the years, you'll find that hierarchy has been pretty well followed. So you might find, for example, that the Prime Ministers of Canada and the Fathers of Confederation and the monarchs are all celebrated by commemoration on Parliament Hill. It's the association with Parliament then that drives that. And they are, of course, significant for all of Canada, but they are not the first tier. They, if you like, they're second or third tier in the hierarchy of commemorations. And it's hard to talk about these as first, second, and third level, because the people who are wishing to have the commemoration always think their commemoration is the most important, and that's a very sensitive issue. And I think that's partly behind the victims of communism thing, that the sense that, you know, this is the most important, for us, this group of people sponsoring it, this is the most important thing we can think of. and therefore deserves the most significant site we can find.
That was Monocle's Tomos Lewis speaking to architect Robert Alsop about the delicate urban design decisions being undertaken in Ottawa. This is Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now, to end the show, we creep onto the catwalk for a preview of one British designer's latest collection. London is in the midst of an invasion by fashion lovers as London Collections Men showcases an array of labels to watch for the coming season. Monocle favourite Oliver Spencer is one designer whose new collection took to the runway. Monocle's Ben Ryland was one of the eagle-eyed observers at this season's show and popped backstage with Oliver after the event to ask how the minimalist sculptor Richard Serra played a role in inspiring his latest collection.
And I felt very confident in the outfits, and I loved the juxtaposedness of the strings. Playing a modern classic using old technology, violins, I mean, it's an amazing thing to me. So it's very juxtaposed and very good. Came through very well, I hope.
Now, I think one of the most interesting aspects of your collection this year is that you have modelled it after a sculptor. Tell me a little bit about your ideas behind that.
Yeah, well, Richard Serra, I mean, I put a huge, great big poster on my wall in my studio, and I'm really involved in the art business, art culture at the moment in any case. And I sat there and I looked at his things, and you start somewhere with a collection, and this is the point where I started at. So I decided to go on with it. It drifted off track from time to time, but that was good. It's just grounds for creativity. Its form, its beauty, colouring, that's about it. To do with the personality of the sculptor as well. Yeah, you can look at him and, you know, it's important to start somewhere, and this is where we started.
Now, there are obviously a lot of different influences that go into everything you create, but there always seems to be some of the classic elements of British fashion design that still seem to seep in from time to time. Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach that, being a British designer and operating on the world stage?
Oh, look, listen, I just do my thing. I mean, really, I've got a great studio on Lambs-Conduit Street. I've got a great kind of way of being there. And we just don't get too wrapped up in anything. We just do our thing. That's a simple way of explaining it. I think when you get involved in the whole thing, maybe it just takes away from everything. I just do what I do, and hopefully people like that.
So it's just your ideas. It's got nothing to do with being a British designer, being an Italian designer, being an anything designer.
It's everything to do with being British, and it's everything to do with being a Londoner right now. You know, London is, in my humble opinion, the creative centre of the world right now. More artists working here than in any other capital in the world.
Now, one other aspect is that you've got textures and lines this year that deliberately clash. Why allow something to deliberately clash? What's the idea behind that?
Because clashing things makes for interesting finish. Doesn't always work, but that doesn't always matter. It's called going too far. I think that's it.
So, in retrospect then, have you gone too far this year?
I hope so.
That was Monocle's Ben Ryland there, speaking to Oliver Spencer behind the scenes of the launch of his brand's Spring-Summer 2016 collection. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries, or suggestions. Don't forget, you can download all of our shows at monocle.com or via iTunes, SoundCloud, or indeed our free Monocle 24 app. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.